So we're here at the final conference of the EuroPAM Scholars Programme, and one of the scholars is going to talk just a little bit about their experience so far, what they've got out of it, where they think it might take them in the future, and how far they've enjoyed working on the policy project. So, over to you.
Hello. So my name is Kledian, and I'm based at Charles University in Prague, and I've been one of the lucky people to partake in this two-year policy program, which has been transformative in many levels. I've realized what it means to be part of a group of people who believe that ideas, when shared and debated, can make real difference. I sign up for the program as an individual, but I think I'm leaving as part of a group or as a part of a network of people who are united by a shared desire to make our societies and Europe, our continent, a better place to live in. I've been part of the group working on disinformation and social media, and we've been trying to find a proactive way to tackle this big threat which our societies and our continent, but the world as a whole, is grappling with in these days. And instead of trying to deplatform or trying to find ways to put down disinformation, we've come up with a solution which could actually be implemented in Europe as a whole in trying to reshape or remodel the information space in a manner that connects the people, the citizens, with the social media platforms in a manner that is horizontal, where people are given the chance to access trustworthy and good journalism via this platform.
Now, the sort of basic idea behind this is a kind of app, as I understand it, which would be a kind of media wallet. Tell us a bit about that idea. I mean, who had the idea in the group? Because somebody must have come up with this. And how did it take off in the discussion?
We actually got inspired for the EU media wallet by a talk last June in Brussels from a high representative from DigiConnect, and he just threw the buzzword in there, and we took it and thought, okay, this is something that we could really build off. And we are right now in a different position as to where we initially started, in terms of everybody came from a different background and perspective, and we had completely different ideas as to where this was going. But as time went by and during the modules, we've been really brainstorming ideas and trying to pin out this of how this is going to look like in the end of the policy proposal. And the idea of this EU media wallet is really a website, not a social media as people perceive of or would think of when thinking of an EU media wallet. It's going to be a platform or a website where different media outlets are going to be a part of, and they're going to put on their content there independently. But this is going to be like a content aggregator, or a place where all these different media contents are going to be united into one single platform, and people do not have to go and browse a specific media outlet separately, but they can find all the information into one single platform.
And so the idea is that younger people who might otherwise not really have access to, quote, quality media, either because it's behind a paywall or has a kind of fuddy-duddy feel to it, which is kind of for an older generation, are given the opportunity to share this free without having to pay for it during a particular number of years. Is that the basic idea behind it? And, I mean, what do you think, I mean, how do you think, you know, young consumers would react to this?
Absolutely right. The youth are at the center of our proposal, and we've been quite intentional in our decision to have a youth free pass from people from 18 to 24, considering that these are extremely important years for the adaptation of certain habits in terms of the media consumption and the news consumption. We believe that it is crucial to give a free pass to this group age, or to this range of people, with the intention of giving them the availability to access good media sources, trustworthy journalism from these formative years, where one builds the habits as to the media they consume, where they consume it, and to the kind of information spaces that they have access to.
Now, what would happen when they reach the age of 24 or 25? I mean, would they have to then start paying for this, or how would that work?
Absolutely. We consider good journalism and good news to be a public good, and as such, it is very important that they get the net needed revenues to be able to sustain themselves in the long term. From the research we have conducted during the course of these 2 years, we've seen that the media outlets are suffering from funding shortages and the inability to sustain themselves in the medium to long term because of the competition, or the high competition, with the social media platforms, where younger people and younger generations are consuming and spending most of their time. So there will be the opportunity for younger adults, which have just turned 24, to access the media wallet by micropayments. So instead of subscribing to a media outlet on a monthly or yearly basis, they can go and look for a specific headline which they're interested in, and they can access that via a very, very short amount of money, and be able to do that.
So they wouldn't have to take out a subscription to the whole newspaper or magazine. They could actually just pay for a particular article or whatever that interested them. But that's when they reach the age of 25.
You're absolutely right. So during this age of from 18 to 24, they will have free access to multiple news articles from different media outlets. But once they turn 24 and this free pass kind of expires, then they will have the availability to still access separate or specific news articles via the media wallet without having to subscribe to a media outlet on a monthly or yearly basis.
Now, you had to work together in a group. I mean, tell us a bit about that experience. I mean, presumably you hadn't been so used to working in a sort of team context in the past. Was that new to you? And how did you adjust to it? And what did you get out of that process?
So this was different. I've been lucky to be part of different teams during my BA and master studies as part of group projects. But I think this really took it to a different, to an extra level in terms of the necessity to compromise and to negotiate certain positions that each one of us held dear to ourselves, and letting go of certain ideas which you really believe in and you think are going to change and transform the society, or even the very idea we've been working on, is something that we've all had to come to terms with. And I think this is where the transformation really occurs, in terms of letting go of certain ideas for the belief that the greater idea at the end of the project is much better, as if one single person worked on it or pushed their own idea at the end of this. So it is very interesting to be part of certain group dynamics, to get to know different working styles and people which work and speak different languages, but are united by the desire to change this information space in the European continent.
So there are a lot of different implications from what you've just said. I mean, one of them obviously is about teamwork and learning how to kind of, you know, give and take in a kind of group context. But a second is the idea of working together with people of other nationalities, other perspectives, other backgrounds. Has that changed your view about the European process? Because this is, I don't know how far you've been involved in European policy and politics before that, but I mean, this has been a deep immersion in the EU and more widely the European policy process. And what have you taken away from this experience about the way Europe works, or could work, or should work?
It's been, despite the challenges notwithstanding, it's been enriching to be in a group of people which share different backgrounds. Because you see how different people approach the problem solving and the policy making process. This is my first experience in a policy making cycle of group of people working towards actually finding a solution to a problem instead of diagnosing, which we academics usually do. And I think this is where the richness of the program actually lies. And in terms of your question as to the European policymaking and how it actually works on day-to-day practices, I think that's the beauty of the European Union, and the beauty and the richness of the people coming and sharing their own cultural backgrounds towards finding a solution that works for everyone is actually the key of this program, and one of the key treasures that the European Union holds in terms of how it conducts policy and how it tries to find compromises in spite of the differences that the different cultures and societies and people bring to the table.
Now, I think in the course of the two-year program, you've had at least two occasions to come here to Brussels, and this is a kind of week-long exposure to Brussels at the moment. What's your feeling about the mood in Brussels as a city having to deal with EU issues? And do you find that there's a kind of pervading pessimism or a greater optimism? Or what's your sense of the mood of European potential, European possibilities?
This is a tricky and difficult question to answer, and because from the many speakers we've had over the course of these 2 days, you really hear diverse perspectives in terms of how the European Union is doing domestically, but also vis-a-vis its relationship with the world as a complex web of countries having to work together to grapple and to find solutions to common threats. Mm-hmm. And I am a optimist in terms of the very purpose on which European Union is built, and how it looks at the problems and how it looks to itself and to the world. And I do believe that we are facing, and European Union is facing, many, many challenges. But if we come together, just like we have come until now, towards finding solutions that are potentially a key way to finding a ground to get to the other side of this, I think there is optimism.
And do you think there are certain things which only the EU can do, which just can't be done at nation state level?
I believe so, because you have so much potential from different EU member states, and when that is brought together, you can utilize it, you can capitalize on that, and try to fix problems which no single country on their own can come to solve by themselves.
What do you think the principal examples of that in today's world are?
One of these things is the EU enlargement, where the EU could actually push towards further enlargement via a clear roadmap, for example, in the Western Balkans. The war on Ukraine has shown Europe and the world what it takes if European Union doesn't act proactively when it comes to its own security. And even though European Union legitimately has many issues to solve internally, I think it's the time that the EU looks also on its close neighborhood and try to act together alongside the member states on the Western Balkans towards clearing up a road where, as you set a clear timeline, that if you fulfill these criteria, we are going to help you and we're going to be on you on this journey towards EU accession. And I think it could really make European Union richer and stronger and better positioned to tackle geopolitical problems that are grappling EU and the world today.
Now, finally, the Europaeum. What's your experience of the Europaeum been?
It's been a very enriching and meaningful journey to me in many, many levels, personally and professionally, and also in terms of getting to know people and expanding my network, which I believe will benefit me and my career and my life in tremendous ways looking ahead. For starters, I've been challenged to work on a policy project, which is very new to me. Up to now, I've only worked on my office or as part of a team doing research, and this is quite a different world, and the policy world is yet a different world, and trying to bridge these two worlds is a process which has learned and taught me so much that I will take on moving forward in my life, and trying to find a language that actually suits to these two worlds, and trying to find a common language where translates to both academia and the policy world.
And so you've made a lot of contacts, but do you think you've also made friendships as a result of this?
I have, and I think it's such a precious thing that I will be taking away from this program, the ability to have made certain contacts and certain friendships, which I believe will stay with me for the rest of my life.
Thank you. Great. And have you any ideas yet what you'd like to do next?
I am puzzled as I've ever been, because this new journey has actually brought me into uncharted territories in terms of rethinking my life again. Until now, I thought that I am pretty good in academia, and I'd like to spend the rest of my life researching and adding to the common scientific knowledge. But this policy program has really made me rethink where I want to be next, and I will definitely reconsider my career options in trying to find something that bridges both academia and the policy world.
Well, thank you very much indeed. That's been great, and we wish you all the best in your future life. And that's just a flavour of what the Scholars Programme has meant to the individuals who've been participating in these last 2 years. Thank you so much.